On the other hand, during 1867, Iowa and Dakota admitted Negroes to the ballot, and Minnesota in 1868. In this latter year, Negroes were voting in all the New England states except Connecticut. In Iowa, Minnesota, and Dakota, a total of 8 northern states. The South and its friends had a right to charge that 8 other northern states refused to enfranchise a class to which they were forcing the South to give the vote. In the third annual message of Andrew Johnson, December 3, 1867, all masking of the Negro problem is removed. He is no longer evasive as to the relation of the black worker to the white worker, and his whole economic argument is drowned in race hate. There is no suggestion that Negro soldiers or Negro property owners or Negroes who can read and write should have any political rights. He bases his whole argument flatly on the inferiority of the Negro race. "It is the glory of white men," he proclaims magniloquently, "to know that they have had these qualities in sufficient measure to build upon this continent a great political fabric, and to preserve its stability for more than 90 years, while in every other part of the world all similar experiments have failed. But if anything can be proved by known facts, if all reasoning upon evidence is not abandoned, it must be acknowledged that in the progress of nations, Negroes have shown less capacity for government than any other race of people. No independent government of any form has ever been successful in their hands. On the contrary, wherever they have been left to their own devices, they have shown a constant tendency to relapse into barbarism. In the southern states, however, Congress has undertaken to confer upon them the privilege of the ballot. Just released from slavery, it may be doubted whether, as a class, they know more than their ancestors how to organize and regulate civil society. Indeed, it is admitted that the blacks of the South are not only regardless of the rights of property, but so utterly ignorant of public affairs that their voting can consist in nothing more than carrying a ballot to the place where they are directed to deposit it. The great difference between the two races in physical, mental, and moral characteristics will prevent an amalgamation or fusion of them together in one homogeneous mass. If the inferior obtains the ascendancy over the other, it will govern with reference only to its own interests, for it will recognize no common interest, and create such a tyranny as this continent has never yet witnessed. Already the Negroes are influenced by promises of confiscation and plunder. They are taught to regard as an enemy every white man who has any respect for the rights of his own race. If this continues, it must become worse and worse until all order will be subverted, all industry cease, and the fertile fields of the South grow up into a wilderness. Of all the dangers which our nation has yet encountered, none are equal to those which must result from the success of the effort now making to Africanize the half of our country. It is easy to believe now that the idea that Andrew Johnson and the South planned a coup d'etat was fanciful. The point is that sane and thoughtful men at the time widely believed it. No matter how incredible it may seem to us, we must remember that this was a generation to which it had seemed incredible that the South should secede. They had seen the incredible happen at fearful cost. It might happen again. The Republicans, therefore, refused to be frightened by the elections of 1867. Carl Schurz said that, "I think that I do not exaggerate that an overwhelming majority of the loyal Union men, North and South, saw in President Johnson a traitor bent upon turning over the national government to the rebels again, and ardently wishing to see him utterly stripped of power, not so much for what he had done, but for what, as they thought, he was capable of doing and likely to do." Impeachment proceedings now hurried forward. They had begun in December 1866. On February 28, 1867, the Committee on Judiciary had refused to recommend impeachment of the president but asked for further investigation. March 2nd, the Reconstruction Act passed, and March 7th, impeachment was moved for the second time in the House. Johnson had notified the Senate of the suspension of Secretary Stanton in December 1867. Early the next year, the Senate refused to concur. Grant gave up the office, and Stanton resumed his duties. Stanton was dismissed again in February 1868, and the impeachment of Johnson was determined upon in March. The beginning of the attempt to impeach President Johnson was a memorable scene. Thaddeus Stevens made his speech February 16, 1868. He was hopelessly broken in health, and a hushed and expectant audience listened to every word. He spoke with force and solemnity. "I doubt," said Charles Sumner, "if words were ever delivered to more effect." He was a dying man, and this was his last word. Who in 1867 represented the considered will of the people of the United States? Certainly not Andrew Johnson, backed by Northern Copperheads and the supporters of a futile attempt at secession. Just as certainly 2/3 of the members of Congress, with the South excluded, as it had been excluded for 6 terrible years, had a clear right to express the repeatedly registered popular will. The problem was a difficult one. When can a ruler rule in the United States? The nation by overwhelming majority had declared for union, for emancipation to preserve the union, for no increase in the political power of the white South, and for the Negro suffrage to prevent this increased political power and reward Negro loyalty. This clear will of the majority of the people represented in Congress was frustrated by a president who repeatedly refused to obey the plain mandate of the party which elected him. Johnson virtually declared Congress illegal because the South was unrepresented. Congress denied that a criminal could be his own judge. Who could settle this dispute? By the whole theory of party government, a president must be at least in general accord with his party. His utmost power should not go beyond a suspensory veto, compelling a plebiscite. Yet no president in the history of the United States up to this time had used the veto power like Andrew Johnson to oppose the expressed will of the nation. In 23 cases, he opposed his will to the will of the Congress, while Andrew Jackson, his closest competitor, made only 11 vetoes and pocket vetoes. Party responsibility in government was absolutely blocked at a time of crisis. Under any, even partial, theory of such responsibility, Johnson would have been compelled to resign. But the antiquated constitutional requirements of a system of laws built for another age and for entirely different circumstances were now being applied to unforeseen conditions. The Constitution made the removal of the president contingent upon his committing high crimes and misdemeanors. Here then came a plain question of definition. Was it a crime, in the judgment of the people of the United States in 1867, for a president to block the overwhelming will of a successful majority of voters during a period of nearly 3 years? Stevens and those who followed him said that it was. They did not all pretend that Johnson was personally a criminal with treasonable designs, although some believed even that. On the other hand, it was clear even to many of Johnson's friends that he was an unfit person to be president of the United States. They all did assert that he had broken the rules by which responsible government could be carried on. The trial started March 30, 1868, and ended May 6. Over 2/3 of the members of the United States House of Representatives, 35 out of 54 senators, and the great majority of the voters of the nation outside the former slave states agreed that Johnson should be removed from office. Whether they were right or wrong, the failure legally to convict Johnson has remained to frustrate responsible government in the United States ever since. But no president since Johnson has attempted indefinitely to rule in defiance of Congress. The leaders of abolition democracy still pressed on. Sumner was especially active and destined for several more years of active work. Thaddeus Stevens was near death, but to the very end he fought on. He wished to ask Congress to declare by law that no state had the right to forbid citizens of the United States from taking part in the national elections. Thaddeus Stevens died August 11, 1868, 3 weeks after the ratification of the 14th Amendment was announced, and, in his last breath, and even after death, stood true to his principles. Two colored clergymen called and asked leave to see Stevens and pray with him. He ordered them to be admitted, and when they had come to his bedside, he turned and held out his hand to one of them. They sang a hymn and prayed. It was then within 10 minutes of midnight, and the end was to come before the beginning of the new day. He lay motionless for a few minutes, then opened his eyes, took one look, placidly closed them, and, without a struggle, the great commoner had ceased to breathe. Thaddeus Stevens was buried in a colored graveyard. Upon the monument there is the following inscription prepared by himself. I repose in this quiet and secluded spot, not from any natural preference for solitude, but finding other cemeteries limited as to race by charter rules. I have chosen this, that I might illustrate in my death the principles which I advocated through a long life, the equality of man before his Creator. As Charles Sumner said, already he takes his place among illustrious names, which are the common property of mankind. I see him now, as I have so often seen him during life. His venerable form moves slowly and with uncertain steps, but the gathered strength of years is in his countenance and the light of victory on his path. Politician, calculator, time server, stand aside. A hero statesman passes to his reward. As a result of the legislation of the 39th and 40th Congresses, the United States in 1867 took a portentous forward step in democracy. For the mass of the nation, it was a step taken under compulsion of fear, without deep forethought, and with a rather didactic following out of certain conventional principles which made universal suffrage seem natural and inevitable. To the South, it was the price of that disaster of slavery and war which spelled its history from 1830 to 1865, and it was the only price adequate to that fatal mistake. To those men who were guiding American industry toward a new and fateful path, the Southern experiment was simply a political move by which they silenced and held in check the tremendous political power built on slavery, which in many ways and for a generation had threatened the nation and checked its economic development. To a few far-seeing leaders of democracy, this experiment appeared in its truer light. It was a test of the whole theory of American government. It was a dictatorship backed by the military arm of the United States by which the governments of the southern states were to be coerced into accepting a new form of administration in which the freedmen and the poor whites were to hold the overwhelming balance of political power. As soon as political power was successfully delivered into the hands of these elements, the federal government was to withdraw and full democracy ensue. The difficulty with this theory was the failure to realize that such dictatorship must last long enough, really, to put the mass of workers in power. That this would be, in fact, a dictatorship of the proletariat, which must endure until the proletariat, or at least a leading united group, with clear objects and effective method, had education and experience and had taken firm control of the economic organization of the South. Unfortunately, the power set to begin this dictatorship was the military arm of a government which more and more was falling into the hands of organized wealth, and of wealth organized on a scale never before seen in modern civilization. The new organization of Northern wealth was not comparable to the petty bourgeoisie which seized power after the overthrow of European feudalism. It was a new rule of associated and federated monarchs of industry and finance, wielding a vaster and more despotic power than European kings and nobles ever held. It was destined to subdue not only southern agrarianism, but even individual wealth and brains in the north, which were creating a new petty bourgeoisie of small merchants and skilled artisans. It was inconceivable, therefore, that the masters of northern industry, through their growing control of American government, were going to allow the laborers of the south any more real control of wealth and industry than was necessary to curb the political power of the planters and their successors. As soon as the southern landholders and merchants yielded to the northern demands of a plutocracy, at that moment the military dictatorship should be withdrawn, and a dictatorship of capital allowed unhampered sway. We see this more clearly today than the nation of 1868 or any of its leaders could possibly envisage it. But even then, northern industry knew that universal suffrage in the South, in the hands of Negroes just freed from slavery and of white people still enslaved by poverty, could not stand against organized industry. They promptly calculated that the same method of controlling the labor vote would come in vogue in the South as they were already using in the North, and that the industry which used these methods must in the meantime cooperate with northern industry, that it could not move the foundation stones upon which northern industry was consolidating its power, that is, the tariff, the money system, the debt, and national in place of state control of industry. This would seem to be what the masters of exploitation were counting upon, and it certainly came true in the bargain of 1876. Thus, by singular coincidence, and for a moment, for the few years of an eternal second in a cycle of 1,000 years, the orbits of two widely and utterly dissimilar economic systems coincided, and the result was a revolution so vast and portentous that few minds ever fully conceived it. For the systems were these. First, that of a democracy, which should, by universal suffrage, establish a dictatorship of the proletariat, ending in industrial democracy. And the other, a system by which a little knot of masterful men would so organize capitalism as to bring under their control the natural resources, wealth, and industry of a vast and rich country, and through that, of the world. For a second, for a pulse of time, these orbits crossed and coincided, but their central suns were 1,000 light-years apart, even though the blind and ignorant fury of the South and the complacent Philistinianism of the North saw them as one. Reconstruction was an economic revolution on a mighty scale and with worldwide reverberation. Reconstruction was not simply a fight between the white and black races in the South, or between master and ex-slave. It was much more subtle. It involved more than this. There have been repeated and continued attempts to paint this era as an interlude of petty politics or a nightmare of race hate, instead of viewing it slowly and broadly as a tremendous series of efforts to earn a living in new and untried ways, to achieve economic security, and to restore fatal losses of capital and investment. It was a vast labor movement of ignorant, earnest, and bewildered black men whose faces had been ground in the mud by their 3 awful centuries of degradation, and who now staggered forwardly, blindly, in blood and tears, amid petty division, hate, and hurt, and surrounded by every disaster of war and industrial upheaval. Reconstruction was a vast labor movement of ignorant, muddled, and bewildered white men who had been disinherited of land and labor and fought a long battle with sheer subsistence, hanging on the edge of poverty, eating clay, and chasing slaves, and now lurching up to manhood. Reconstruction was the turn of white northern migration southward to new and sudden economic opportunity which followed the disaster and dislocation of war, and an attempt to organize capital and labor on a new pattern and build a new economy. Finally, Reconstruction was a desperate effort of a dislodged, maimed, impoverished and ruined oligarchy and monopoly to restore an anachronism in economic organization by force, fraud, and slander, in defiance of law and order, and in the face of a great labor movement of white and black, and in bitter strife with a new capitalism and a new political framework. All these contending and antagonistic groups spoke different and unknown tongues. To the Negro, freedom was God. To the poor, white freedom was nothing. He had more than he had use for. To the planter, freedom for the poor was laziness, and for the rich, control of the poor worker. For the northern businessman, freedom was opportunity to get rich. Yet with interpretation, agreement was possible here. North and South agreed that laborers must produce profit. The poor white and the Negro wanted to get the profit arising from the laborer's toil and not to divide it with the employers and landowners. When Northern and Southern employers agreed that profit was most important and the method of getting it second, the path to understanding was clear. When white laborers were convinced that the degradation of Negro labor was more fundamental than the uplift of white labor, the end was in sight. Not only did all those factors becloud this extraordinary series of movements, so that the truth of the matter in itself was baffling to observers and interpreters, but over all has spread to this day a cloud of lying and slander which leaves historians and philosophers aghast and has resulted in a current theory of interpretation which pictures all participants as scoundrels, idiots, and heroes. A combination humanly improbable and demonstrably untrue. One cannot study Reconstruction without first frankly facing the facts of universal lying, of deliberate and unbounded attempts to prove a case and win a dispute and preserve economic mastery and political domination by besmirching the character, motives, and common sense of every single person who dared disagree with the dominant philosophy of the white South. The campaign of slander against carpetbaggers rose to a climax, which included every Northern person who defended the Negro and every Northern person in the South who was connected with the Army or Freedmen's Bureau or with the institutions of learning or who admitted the right of the Negro to vote or defended him in any way. It was the general, almost universal belief that practically without exception, these people were liars, jailbirds, criminals, and thieves, and the hatred of them rose to a crescendo of curses and filth. Later, this universal attack upon the carpetbaggers was modified considerably, and it was admitted that there were among them some decent and high-minded men, although most of them still were regarded as selfish stealers of public funds. On the other hand, so far as the Negro was concerned, almost no exceptions were admitted. It was easier to traduce him because everyone was ready to believe the worst, and no reply was, for the moment, listened to. There was not a single great black leader of Reconstruction against whom almost unprintable allegations were not repeatedly and definitely made without any attempt to investigate the reliability of sources of information. For the first time in national history, interstate migration became a crime. Hundreds of thousands of Southerners had gone north and west and had been welcomed and integrated into the various states despite their divergent ideas and alien heredity. But when there came a comparatively small number of Northerners into the South, they were reviled unless they conformed absolutely in thought and action with a dead past. The Northern whites were of many classes. Former soldiers and officers, lingering in the South in connection with the Army or the Freedmen's Bureau, or as investors and farmers. They were reinforced by an army of men who came South with small capital and in many cases succeeded in making their fortune. Most of these had no especial love for the Negroes. They had come into the white man's war, and now that the Negro was free, they were perfectly free to use him and to organize his industrial and political power for their own advantage. Many of these were agents for capital, and went down from the North with something of the psychology of modern investment in conquered or colonial territory. That is, they brought the capital. They invested it. They remained in charge to oversee the profits, and they acquired political power in order to protect these profits. On the other hand, there were teachers who came down from the North, army chaplains, social workers, and others who wholeheartedly went into the new democracy to the limit. Extraordinary persons stood forth in this role, like General Fisk and Erastus Cravath at Nashville, Edmund Ware at Atlanta, General Armstrong at Hampton, and dozens of others. They were crusaders in a great cause and meticulously honest. Naturally, their numbers were comparatively small. They reached primarily students, teachers, and preachers among the Negroes, and only incidentally, the class of field hands. It was a battle between oligarchy, whose wealth and power had been based on land and slaves on the one hand, and on the other, oligarchy built on machines and hired labor. The newly organized industry of the North was not only triumphant in the North, but began pressing in upon the South. Its advance guard was represented by those small northern capitalists and office holders who sought to make quick money in raising cotton and taking advantage of the low-priced labor and high cotton prices due to the war famine. The labor on the market, instead of being owned like the slaves or excluded from competition like the poor whites, suddenly found itself bid for and offered not only money wages but political power and social status. The bidders had no realization at first how high their labor bids were in Southern custom. They were offering something below the current price of labor in all civilized lands. The Northern United States, England, France, most of Germany, and parts of Italy were giving labor some voice in governing and a money wage contract. To the plantation planters, such a wage contract was economic heresy and social revolution. It was blasphemy and eternal damnation to them, and they fought by every conceivable weapon, political power, social influence, murder, assassination, and systematic lying. The mass of poor whites were in an anomalous position. Those of them who were intelligent, or who had during slavery accumulated any capital or achieved any position, had always attached themselves in sympathy and interest to the planter class. This meant that the mass of ignorant poor white labor had practically no intelligent leadership. Only here and there were there men, like Hinton Helper, who were actual leaders of the poor whites against the planters. The poor white was in a quandary with regard to emancipation. He had viewed slavery as the cause of his own degradation, but he now viewed the free Negro as a threat to his very existence. Suppose that freedom for the Negro meant that Negroes might rise to be landholders, planters, and employers? The poor whites thus might lose the last shred of respectability. They had been used to seeing certain classes of the black slaves above them in economic prosperity and social power, but after all, they were still Negroes and slaves. Now that freedom had come, poor whites were faced by the dilemma of recognizing the Negroes as equals, or of bending every effort to still keep them beneath the white mass in income and social power. Here and there, certain leaders appeared among the planters, among the more intelligent of the poor whites, and even among the masses, who looked toward political combination and economic alliance with the Negro. Such persons the Southerners called scalawags. But they were, in fact, that part of the white South who saw a vision of democracy across racial lines and who were willing to build up a labor party in opposition to capitalists and landholders. They were, therefore, especially to be feared and were endlessly reviled. They were forced into certain extreme positions as compared with the carpetbagger and the planter. Men like Hunnicutt of Virginia asked not only political rights, but full social equality for the Negroes, and taunted planters and the carpetbaggers when they did not dare advocate this. When Andrew Johnson said in his veto of the Reconstruction Bill, March 2, 1867, "The Negroes have not asked for the privilege of voting. The vast majority of them have no idea what it means," he was exaggerating. Negroes had certainly voted, not only in the North, but in South Carolina in the 18th century, and in North Carolina, Louisiana, and Tennessee in the 19th. They had asked to vote in the South repeatedly since emancipation. The difference that now came was that an indefinitely larger number of Negroes than ever before was enfranchised suddenly, and 99% of them belonged to the laboring class, whereas, by law, the Negroes who voted in the early history of the country were, for the most part, property holders and prospective, if not actual, constituents of a petty bourgeoisie. When freedom came, this mass of Negro labor was not without intelligent leadership, and a leadership which, because of former race prejudice and the present color line, could not be divorced from the laboring mass, as had been the case with the poor whites. The group of intelligent, free Negroes in Washington, Richmond, Charleston, and especially New Orleans had accumulated some wealth and some knowledge of group cooperation and initiative. Almost without exception, they accepted the new responsibility of leading the emancipated slaves unselfishly and effectively. Free Negroes from the North, most of whom had been born in the South and knew conditions, came back in considerable numbers during Reconstruction and took their place as leaders. The result was that the Negroes were not, as they are sometimes painted, simply a mass of densely ignorant toilers. The rank and file of black labor had a notable leadership of intelligence during Reconstruction times. It was, however, a leadership which was not at all clear in its economic thought. On the whole, it believed in the accumulation of wealth and the exploitation of labor as the normal method of economic development, but it also believed in the right to vote as the basis and defense of economic life, and gradually, but surely, it was forced by the demand of the mass of Negro laborers to face the problem of land. Thus the Negro leaders gradually, but certainly, turned toward emphasis on economic emancipation. They wanted the Negro to have the right to work at a decent rate of wages, and they expected that the right to vote would come when he had sufficient education and perhaps a certain minimum of property to deserve it. It was this, among other things, that was the cause of the tremendous push toward education which the Negroes exhibited. On the other hand, their desire for economic enfranchisement, for real abolition of slavery, had been affronted by the black codes. They were scared and hampered in the very beginning of their freedom by these enactments and by the way in which these and other laws were executed. The government replied before the death of Abraham Lincoln with government guardianship in the shape of the Freedmen's Bureau. This bureau never had a real chance to organize and function properly. It was hastily organized. It had to use the persons at hand and on the ground largely for its personnel. It had at first no government appropriations, and in the end, only limited appropriations, and it was always faced by the probability of quick dissolution. It was surrounded from the beginning by the spirit which enacted the black codes. Southerners were desperately opposed to it because it stood between them and the exploitation of labor toward which they were impelled by their losses and the high price of cotton. If they had been allowed to exploit and drive black labor after the war, many Southerners, despite their losses, could have partially recouped their fortunes. But here came an organization which demanded money wages of employers who had no money, and demanded the modern treatment of labor from former slave drivers. Beside the Freedmen's Bureau and before it, there was the chance for the Negroes to seek the advice of their former masters, and in many cases, this was willingly and wisely given, particularly in the case of masters ready to assist a new economic regime. But it was hindered by several considerations. First, any new union between former masters and Negroes was rekindling the old enmity and jealousy of the poor whites against any combination of the white employer and the black laborer, which would again exclude the poor white. The planter, therefore, had to be careful of any open sympathy or cooperation with the black laborer. Already his ranks had been decimated by war, and his social status threatened by poverty. Then, too, insofar as the black laborer was guided by the Freedmen's Bureau, by Northern philanthropy and by Northern capital, he brought upon himself the bitter enmity of the former master, so that on the whole, while there was considerable advice and help from the former master, in the long run, it did not and could not amount to much. Then, too, We must remember that these former slaveholders did not believe that Negroes could advance in freedom. They knew, of course, that some could, but even if these could, how could white men and masters cooperate with them? The whole trend of teaching had been that this was utterly impossible. If Negroes succeeded, and insofar as they did, it would lead straight to social equality and amalgamation. And if they did not succeed, it would lead to deterioration in culture and civilization. The real economic battle, then, lay finally in a series of attempted compromises between planters, carpetbaggers, scalawags, poor white laborers, and Negroes. First, the planters moved toward the political control of Negroes to fix their economic control. This the poor whites had, of course, feared, and their fears were voiced repeatedly by Andrew Johnson. Many people in the North looked upon this as a possible and threatening answer to the enfranchisement of the blacks. The combination was frustrated because the carpetbaggers offered the Negroes better terms, offered them the right to vote and to hold office and some economic freedom. When this economic freedom looked toward landholding and higher wages, it could be accomplished only at the expense of the employing class, and so far as Negro labor accepted, as it had to accept the offer of the carpetbaggers and scalawags, it alienated the planters, and not only that, but it frightened the poor whites. Here again, as in the case of slavery, there was a combination in which the poor whites seemed excluded, unless they made common cause with the blacks. This union of black and white labor never got a real start. First, because black leadership still tended toward the ideals of the petty bourgeois, and white leadership tended distinctly toward strengthening capitalism. The final move which rearranged all these combinations and led to the catastrophe of 1876 was a combination of planters and poor whites in defiance of their economic interests, and with the use of lawless murder and open intimidation. It was a combination that could only have been stopped by government force, and the army which was the agent of the federal government was sustained in the South by the organized capital of the North. All that was necessary, then, was to satisfy Northern industry that the new combination in the South was essentially a combination which aimed at capitalistic exploitation on conventional terms. The result was the withdrawal of military support and the revolutionary suppression not only of Negro suffrage, but of the economic development of Negro and white labor. It was not until after the period which this book treats that white labor in the South began to realize that they had lost a great opportunity, that when they united to disfranchise the black laborer, they had cut the voting power of the laboring class in two. White labor in the populist movement of the 80s tried to realign the economic warfare in the South and bring workers of all colors into united opposition to the employer. But they found that the power which they had put in the hands of the employers in 1876 so dominated political life that free and honest expression of public will at the ballot box was impossible in the South, even for white men. They realized that it was not simply the Negro who had been disfranchised in 1876, it was the white laborer as well. The South had since become one of the greatest centers for exploitation of labor in the world, and labor suffered not only in the South, but throughout the country and the world over. Curious and contradictory has been the criticism and comment accompanying this great controversy and revolution of 1866 through 1876. Floods of tears and sentiment have been expended on the suffering and disillusionment of the slave baron, while the equally great losses of Northern and Southern labor have been forgotten. And above all, the plight of the most helpless victims of the situation, the black freedmen, has been treated with callous and hardened judgments, cemented with hate. The Northern businessman has justly been accused of being motivated during this period chiefly by greed and profit. But the profit and greed of the slaveholder, which caused the whole catastrophe, and of the planter, who forced an unjust and still dangerous solution, has been sicklied over with sentiment. In all this, one sees the old snobbery of class judgment in new form. Tears and sentiment for Marie Antoinette on the scaffold, but no sign of grief for the gutters of Paris and the fields of France, where the victims of exploitation and ignorance lay rotting in piles. The South, after the war, presented the greatest opportunity for a real national labor movement which the nation ever saw, or is likely to see for many decades. Yet the labor movement, with but few exceptions, never realized the situation. It never had the intelligence or knowledge as a whole to see in black slavery and Reconstruction the kernel and meaning of the labor movement in the United States. After Lincoln's assassination, the General Council of the International Working Men's Association, under Karl Marx, sent an address to Andrew Johnson. After a gigantic civil war, which, if we consider its colossal extension and its vast scenes of action, seems in comparison with the Hundred Years' War and the 30 Years' War and the 23 Years' War of the Old World scarcely to have lasted 90 days. The task, sir, devolves upon you to uproot by law what the sword has felled, and to preside over the more difficult work of political reconstruction and social regeneration. The profound consciousness of your great mission will preserve you from all weakness in the execution of your stern duties. You will never forget that the American people at the inauguration of the new era of the emancipation of labor placed the burden of leadership on the shoulders of two men of labor, Abraham Lincoln, the one, and the other, Andrew Johnson. In 1865, September, another address over the signature of Marx declared boldly, "Injustice against a fraction of your people having been followed by such dire consequences, put an end to it. Declare your fellow citizens from this day forth free and equal without any reserve. If you refuse them citizens' rights while you exact from them citizens' duties, you will sooner or later face a new struggle which will once more drench your country in blood." The National Labor Union of Workers was organized at Baltimore, Maryland, August 20, 1866. There were 60 delegates, and on their banner was inscribed, "Welcome to the Sons of Toil from the North, East, South, and West." An address was issued on cooperation, trade unions, apprenticeship, strikes, labor of women, public land, and political action. As to the Negroes, the union admitted that it was unable to express an opinion which would satisfy all, but the question must not be allowed to pass unnoticed. The Negro worker had been neglected. Cooperation of the African race and systematic organization must be secured. Otherwise, Negroes must act as scabs, as in the case of colored caulkers imported from Virginia to Boston during the strike on the 8-hour question. There should be no distinction of race or nationality, but only separation into two great classes, laborers and those who live by others' labor. Negroes were soon to be admitted to citizenship and the ballot. Their ballot strength would be of great value to union labor. If labor did not accept them, capital would use the labor to split white and black labor, just as the Austrian government had used race dissension. Such a lamentable situation should not be allowed to develop in America. Trade unions, 8-hour leagues, and other groups should be organized among Negroes. Here was a first halting note. Negroes were welcomed to the labor movement not because they were laborers, but because they might be competitors in the market, and the logical conclusion was either to organize them or guard against their actual competition by other methods. It was to this latter alternative that white American labor almost unanimously turned. This was a manifest at the second annual meeting in Chicago in 1867, where the Negro problem was debated more frankly and less successfully. The president called attention to Negroes whose emancipation come in competition with white labor. He suggested that the best way to meet this situation was to form trade unions among Negroes. A committee of three on Negro labor was selected. The Committee on Negro Labor reported that having had the subject under consideration, and after having heard the suggestions and opinions of several members of this convention, pro and con, they had arrived at the following conclusions. That, while we feel the importance of the subject, and realize the danger in the future of competition in mechanical Negro labor, yet we find the subject involved in so much mystery, and upon it so wide diversity of opinion amongst our members, we believe that it is inexpedient to take action on the subject in this National Labor Congress. Resolved, that the subject of Negro labor be laid over till the next session of the National Labor Congress. The report of this committee brought a whirlwind of discussion which lasted throughout the whole day. The Negro will bear to be taught his duty, and has already stood his ground nobly when a member of a trades union did not like to confess to the world that there was a subject with which they were afraid to cope. This very question was at the root of the rebellion, which was the war of the poor white men of the South, who were forced by the slaveholders into the war. In New Haven, there were a number of respectable colored mechanics, but they had not been able to induce the trades unions to admit them. Was there any union in the States which would admit colored men? The colored man was industrious and susceptible of improvement and advancement. There was no need of entering on any discussion of the matter. There was no necessity for the foisting of the subject of colored labor or the appointment of a committee to report thereon. The blacks would combine together of themselves and by themselves without the assistance of whites. God speed them, but let not the whites try to carry them on their shoulders. Time enough to talk about admitting colored men to trades unions and to the Congress when they applied for admission. Whites striking against the blacks and creating an antagonism which will kill off the trades unions unless the two be consolidated. There is no concealing the fact that the time will come when the Negro will take possession of the shops if we have not taken possession of the Negro. If the working men of the white race do not conciliate the black vote will be cast against them. The capitalists of New England now employ foreign boys and girls in their mills, to the almost entire exclusion of the native-born population. They would seek to supplant these by colored workers. Little danger of black men wanting to enter trades unions any more than Germans would try to join the English societies in America. The whole question was finally dodged by taking refuge in the fact that the Constitution invited all labor. Silvis, president of the International Labor Movement, spoke out in 1868 on slavery. Whatever our opinions may be as to immediate causes of the war, we can all agree that human slavery, property in man, was the first great cause. And from the day that the first gun was fired, it was my earnest hope that the war might not end until slavery ended it. No man in America rejoiced more than I at the downfall of Negro slavery. But when the shackles fell from the limbs of those 4 millions of blacks, it did not make them free men. It simply transferred them from one condition of slavery to another. It placed them upon the platform of the white working men and made all slaves together. I do not mean that freeing the Negro enslaved the white. I mean that we were slaves before, always have been, and that the abolition of the right of property in man added 4 millions of black slaves to the white slaves of the country. We are now all one family of slaves together, and the labor reform movement is a second emancipation proclamation. In the meeting of the National Labor Union in New York in 1868, there was no mention of Negroes, but in 1869 at Philadelphia, among 142 representatives, there appeared 9 Negroes representing various separate Negro unions and organizations. This pointed a way out, which labor eagerly seized. Contrary to all labor philosophy, they would divide labor by racial and social lines, and yet continue to talk of one labor movement. Through this separate union, Negro labor would be restrained from competition, and yet kept out of the white race unions where power and discussion lay. A resolution was adopted saying that the National Labor Union would recognize neither color nor sex in the question of the rise of all labor, and the colored laborers were urged to form their own organizations and send delegates to the next conference. The Negroes responded and declared that all Negroes wanted was a fair chance, and no one would be the worse off for giving it. Isaac Myers, their leader, said, "The white laboring men of the country have nothing to fear from the colored laboring men. We desire to see labor elevated and made respectable. We desire to have the highest rate of wages that our labor is worth. We desire to have the hours of labor regulated as well to the interest of the laborer as to the capitalist. Mr. President, American citizenship for the black man is a complete failure if he is proscribed from the workshops of the country." In 1869, the General Council of the National Working Men's Association sent a letter signed by Karl Marx to the president of the National Labor Union. The immediate tangible result of the Civil War was, of course, a deterioration of the condition of American working men. Both in the United States and in Europe, the colossal burden of a public debt was shifted from hand to hand in order to settle it upon the shoulders of the working class. "The prices of necessaries," remarks one of your statesmen, "have risen 78% since 1860, while the wages of simple manual labor have risen 50%, and those of skilled labor 60%. "Pauperism," he complains, "is increasing in America more rapidly than population. Moreover, the sufferings of the working class are in glaring contrast to the newfangled luxury of financial aristocrats, shoddy aristocrats, and other vermin bred by the war. Still, the Civil War offered a compensation in the liberation of the slaves and the impulse which it thereby gave your own class movement. Another war, not sanctified by a sublime aim or a social necessity, but like the wars of the old world, would forge chains for the free working men instead of sundering those of the slaves." Silvius, president of the International Labor Movement, acknowledged this letter, but said nothing about slavery, confining himself to attacking the moneyed aristocracy. Thus, American labor leaders tried to emphasize the fact that here was a new element. Not new in the sense that it had not been there, it had been there all the time, but new in the sense that the Negro worker must now be taken account of, both in his own interest and particularly in their interest. He was a competitor and a prospective underbidder. Then difficulties appeared. The white worker did not want the Negro in his unions, did not believe in him as a man, dodged the question, and when he appeared at conventions, asked him to organize separately, that is, outside the real labor movement, in spite of the fact that this was a contradiction of all sound labor policy. As the Negro laborers organized separately, there came slowly to realization the fact that here was not only separate organization, but a separation in leading ideas. Because among Negroes, and particularly in the South, there was being put into force one of the most extraordinary experiments of Marxism that the world, before the Russian Revolution, had seen. That is, backed by the military power of the United States, a dictatorship of labor was to be attempted, and those who were leading the Negro race in this vast experiment were emphasizing the necessity of the political power and organization backed by protective military power. On the other hand, the trade union movement of the white labor in the North was moving away from that idea and moving away from politics. They seemed to see a more purely economic solution in their demand for higher wages and shorter hours. Ira Stewart spoke for men who labor excessively, robbed of all ambition to ask for anything more than will satisfy their bodily necessities, while those who labor moderately have time to cultivate tastes and create wants in addition to mere physical comforts. But Stewart was not thinking of Negroes, and only once barely mentioned them. That we rejoice that the rebel aristocracy of the South has been crushed, that we rejoice that beneath the glorious shadow of our victorious flag, men of every clime, lineage, and color are recognized as free. But while we will bear with patient endurance the burden of the public debt, we yet want it to be known that the working men of America will in future claim a more equal share in the wealth their industry creates in peace, and a more equal participation in the privileges and blessings of those free institutions defended by their manhood on many a bloody field of battle.